This morning we are in the book of Daniel. I will tell you, this is an emotional book for me. It is beyond what my words can express, the depth of emotion about this book. The reason being is I've got a chapter in my life. It was the last time that I got to teach the book of Daniel cohesively, systematically to a large group. And the group I taught it to, I think they forever changed my life. I met with a group of Christians who are in a hostile country, a country whose government is strongly opposed to them as believers. In this group of believers who had gotten together, even had to come out of the country and meet on the other side of the river. In this, there were brand new believers who were just finding out what it was like to follow Jesus Christ, but we were training them for leadership because there's no one else around them. There were what I would call grizzled old veterans of the Christian walk, a handful of those, but they had suffered and taken it on the chin. They had been beat from pillar to post. They hadn't had Bibles in their own language and in their own hand for years. We were doing leadership training. And so I would gather in a room with translators, and I was asked if I would teach the book of Daniel to them over the days. I will tell you, that was one of the most powerful, profound experiences I've ever had. I recognize such inadequate training. How do I stand there and teach them how to live in a hostile world like a Daniel and a Shadrach and a Meshach and Abednego in a culture that is trying to drive them into the dirt? How do I teach that? The answer is the book of Daniel will teach itself. Sitting in front of me was a woman who had come out of a re-education camp, and they had told her, "You're hanging around with these Christians and you're studying the Bible in 3 months of re-education camp." But she said it was good. It was cleansing. And we taught the book. I know what the book did in their lives. It wasn't only that book. It was other teaching we were doing that week as well, but this was maybe one of the primary places on what it means to stand unbowed. You need to know that the people who took that training as they studied this book of Daniel, people just like yourselves in many ways, people who profess a faith in Jesus Christ, as they held and understood what God had to say, here's what happened to them. You need to know the rest of the story. You need to know that some of those in that room went back home and continued to share the gospel and continued to create an underground quiet church, and some of them, police officers, came and took them away. And they went to jail for a while. You need to know that some of them in other provinces, the government drove up in trucks and said, "You are to load everything you have. You cannot keep this land anymore. You have violated everything of our culture. You're not allowed to live here anymore. Your kids, your grandkids, you are to load up in the truck and go." Others of them, with a gentle man who was their primary teacher, police officers came and picked him up a little over a year ago, and he has not been seen since. My guess is that one of the men who helped to speak the language, we would speak to a translator, a translator would give the language, and then this godly man who would hear part of the translation, but he knew the book of Daniel so well, he would help and add to it. Cover me, really, is what he did. I think they executed the man. If he has not been executed, then I believe he is in a cell buried deep in a system that will not tell where he is, that he's even alive. And those were the people I last studied this book with. My question that I have of this is, what will be the repercussions in our life when we study the book? What takes place? What are the results of me saying, "God, what's your will for my life?" And God saying, "I'll show you what my will for your life is. If you're willing to live by faith, this is what it will look like." And so we open the book. I think, with trembling hands, because this book means something. It is the marker of this road called faith. Turn, if you would, to the book of Daniel, Daniel, the third chapter. We'll summarize a lot of it in trying to get through this morning. In Daniel, the third chapter, I don't know if you've watched the History Channel, but King Nebuchadnezzar is the king over Babylon. He has the largest empire that has been known to that time. It looks like blood when they put it on the History Channel, the map, just how far his kingdom goes, east and west. Nebuchadnezzar is the voice that the whole world shakes on in many ways. Nebuchadnezzar, and I won't give you all the background, but he has these Jewish boys that are carried off, and now they're in his service. King Nebuchadnezzar builds a tower. He builds a statue 90 foot high and 9 foot wide, and it's made of gold. He has an orchestra. He's set out on the plain, and he brings especially all of the leaders, all of those who would swear allegiance to him, and he has the orchestra there, and he said, when you hear the orchestra, you bow down and you worship. You worship me. Your allegiance to me, that's what you do. And if you don't do it, I'll throw you into the furnace. Well, they would have known what the furnaces were. In fact, there would have been a series of furnaces. There, we've dug those up. Those are easy to find. He had massive building programs. You couldn't have gone to New York City as a kid. You couldn't have gone to Chicago. You couldn't go to anything on the face of the earth as a kid and been more impressed than you would have been with his kingdom, with Babylon. He had brick furnaces everywhere. There's a whole row after row after row of brick furnaces. And here's what he says, I'll throw you in and you will be devoured by the fire. You bow. You have Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And they are boys, young men. The timeline on this is not precisely known at what age they were at this particular story. I don't know where Daniel is. I don't know whether Daniel is out further somewhere else in the kingdom, so he's not there at the place and the time. I don't know whether Daniel is just like them, and he doesn't bow, but nobody told on him. I don't know what the story is. But I do know this. When the time came and the orchestra played, these three guys wouldn't bow. And they stood. The sound of thousands of people bowing and going to the dirt must have been a horrifying sound when you stand and you stand unbowed. It says that a group of Chaldeans, that's an ethnic group, a group of Chaldeans went and said, there are three guys that are in the service of the king. They didn't bow, king. Thought you'd want to know that. I mean, we were bowing, but we kind of opened our eyes that one time during our prayer, and we noticed they didn't bow. Here they are. It's obvious in the text that the king has somewhat of an affinity for these guys, because here's what he does. He calls them and says, you have another chance. Maybe he didn't hear quite right. Maybe there was a translation problem. Maybe something got lost in how we work through this. But I'll tell you, I'll let bygones be bygones. The statue's still here. The orchestra's still here. We're going to play it again. You get a second chance. And this time, if you'll bow, we'll forget all about it. It's no problem. But if you don't bow, you'll go into the furnace. And what God's able to save you then? I guess I would start with this. Do you have enough faith deep in your backbone and your character to stand? Not in the greenhouse, but in the face of the foul stench and the hot breath of a culture. Are you able to stand with your faith, practicing your faith in fearful places? Because the fearful places of this world is where your faith in God will take you. You're going to stand in front of fearful men. You're going to stand in front of fearful forces. What is your faith? What is its nature and its character? Can you practice your faith in fearful places? The first part of their faith is clearly expressed in verses 16 and 17. Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to defend ourselves before you in this matter. If we are thrown into the blazing furnace, the God we serve is able to save us from it, and he will rescue us from your hand, O king. Now, I want you to know, we'll later on recognize, they didn't know what was going to happen to them. When they say he is able to save us, they were thinking in more eternal view, I think. They didn't know what was going to take place with them. We know that from the next verse. We'll talk about it later. But here's what they said. We stand unbowed. We won't bow. Compromise is always possible. Compromise, in fact, seems so easy and convenient. I imagine my own thinking. What would I have done? I can imagine thinking, going, well, we'll bow, but I won't worship. I mean, bowing is kind of like saying Pledge of Allegiance. I mean, I can bow, but I'm not worshiping, and he won't know. Or maybe I could say this, I will bow, but my fingers are crossed. God knows my fingers are crossed. Didn't really mean it. Here's what I'll do. I will evaluate the situation and say, you know what? God's not really into legalism, and we could have more influence for the kingdom if we're not legalistic on this matter. And if we're not legalistic, I think we could impact and advance the kingdom of God in stronger and better ways. And somehow bowing is actually a way of influencing the culture more. I can think of a thousand ways. I can think of phrases of, go, I didn't want to bow, but I was just too stinking scared. God, please forgive me. I was really, really scared. You're a gracious God. It's easy to rationalize. I remember my first sermon that I was ever cognitive of. I was 33. By the way, yesterday we were laughing. They wondered if you could bring water in the worship service, and Steve Dennis, our facility manager, said, yes, you just can't open it. So anyhow, that's our official answer. I get to know it. I was a little kid. Irv Dally was the preacher. I was just a little kid. And Irv Dally told a story. It's a story many of you have heard. But I think it was the day I finally got it and understood it a little bit. It's a story about a young man who was a Christian young man. And he'd got a summer job, and he'd been hired by the lumberjacks and the timber workers up in the Northwest. And his grandma took him aside and says, sweetheart, you're a Christian, and it won't be easy, and I'll be praying for you. And he went off with the lumberjacks and the timber workers. At the end of the summer, he came back, and grandma said, sweetheart, how was it? Because I know those are pretty pagan guys, and I know that's a pretty rough place. How did it work out, you being Christian? How did they handle that? And I remember the punchline. As a little boy, I sat there as the story finished with the young man going, it turned out fine, Grandma. They never found out. And somehow I think I began to understand it is not possible to hold what I would say is a faith in Jesus Christ, a faith in the living God, that I'm not forced to stand in fearful places. That is the nature of the thing called it is easy to rationalize. We're in a culture that's got competing claims for our loyalty. And as long as you don't stand, as long as you don't step out, as long as you don't do anything, you'll fit in fine. But it's when you stand unbowed in the face of that foul breath, that's when the difficulties come. And that's why some people in this room, and I don't know who, but I know it to be a fact, you do too. That's why some people in this room mostly do nothing in the Christian life. Because the Christian life calls you to do something, and you've lived a Christian life that's made no claims, created no scars, made nothing that you ever had to bow down to. You have found ways to compromise that you never even acknowledged. That's what it was. One of the young ladies standing here, her own story, she said, I grew up in an atheist home, and she said it was very easy for me to have a certain animosity even toward the idea of a God. She said, I was 19 years old when a friend, a believer, began to share with me, and somebody began, she said, I rejected it so strong, but bit by bit I couldn't reject what was taking place in the truth and the transformation. And she said, I was 19 years old. She said, now I grew up in an atheist home, and I can tell you I was never struck or beaten or abused or my face hit with fists. To the day as a 19-year-old, I went home and told my parents, I'm a Christian. If you live a faith, it will always take you to fearful places. In fact, if you live a faith, you'll bring men and women of addictions into your life, and you will invest and pour your life into people who are living so at risk. You'll live with hospitality, and people will be in your guest bedroom that would have shocked you when you were a kid. People who you will love on and talk till 2 o'clock in the morning. People you'll chase down railroad tracks because of how chaotic their life is. And you will sit and you will hug and you will weep and you will put your life at risk. You'll even wonder in the back of your mind, I wonder if this person would ever rob us because we brought this in. And the answer is they may. You'll wonder, I read the paper where somebody did these kinds of horrible things. Will my life be killed because they come back in a drunken stupor and they know something? Or maybe they're the passion for how in the world do I know that I won't be killed for what we brought into our own home and our own life? My life is no great witness of anything either. But there's times Julie has worried a great deal about me with people that I went and met with. At times we wondered, they're so difficult to work with. Do they know what the life pattern is? That's where your faith takes you as well. If your life doesn't take you to fearful places, then don't kid yourself. You're not walking a life of faith. For some of you, you will speak of your faith in public ways and be transparent in your love for Christ, and you'll speak in front of people with whom there's repercussions. Repercussions professionally, repercussions in all kinds of advancement, repercussions business-wise, repercussions in every which way. Do you stand unbowed? The nature and the call of Christ is you cannot stand with one foot in the world and one foot with a love for Christ and stand with integrity. Some of you will take your money and you will spend it in ways. You will spend your money so lavishly, you will give it in such generous ways that if God doesn't take care of you, you are going to be in serious trouble. And the question is, will God take care of me? Is handled every day as you handle your money. Do you let your faith take you to fearful places? Some of you will get up and go to hostile places, and you'll live among the Hindu and the Muslims, and you'll live in places where you will love, but you have no guarantee what happens to your family and your future. Will your faith take you to fearful places? Some of you will stand and hug and kiss your kids goodbye at airports. And as they fly away to do what it is they do in the service of the King, you want to cry out with every fiber, why don't you just bow a little? Other people bow a little and they seem to get along fine. Please bow a little. And yet you don't want to do that. And yet you find that your faith takes you to fearful places. A lot of people avoid fearful places. I don't have a GPS system. I haven't bought one yet. But I understand that some of you, and I've been in the cars with you, even have the one that verbalizes. I've about decided that most people at least have an inbuilt GPS system that would help you avoid danger if you listen to it. Because that inbuilt GPS system will say, danger ahead, you keep doing what you're doing, it's going to create danger, turn left, turn left, turn left. And we have learned to listen to a voice that causes us to always avoid the hard things. Never do the hard things. There's nothing hard about enduring a 35-minute sermon, not really. There's nothing hard about singing songs that if you were selecting them, you'd choose different songs. There's nothing hard about sitting in a place where going, wow, the air conditioning blows pretty hard where I sat. I wished I were on the other side. I'm more comfortable. Hey, again, all of the great travail of the Christian life. When I read the book of Daniel, I'm called back and going, do you have any courage for Christ? If you do, you're going to always be in fearful places. Just part of it. I want you to notice the call of Christ. It's very, very, very simple. In the book of Habakkuk, it says, the righteous will live by faith. Paul will say, we walk by faith. The writer of Hebrews will say, this is faith. and Daniel say, this is the faith of God's people. Faith is fidelity to God, and where God goes, so do I. Where his great strides take him, where his great love takes him, so do I. Unbowed, uncompromising, unswerving. Verse 17. If we are thrown in the blazing furnace, the God we serve is able to save us. But they didn't know if he would or not. They didn't know what God was going to do, but it didn't matter. We'll stand unbowed. There were three things they believed. They believed that God is, that he's real, and that God is present. That God is. They secondly believed that God is active and personal. A God who knows us. And a God who knows what we do. And thirdly, they believe that God is able and powerful. And in light of his power, Nebuchadnezzar, we won't bow. I think those three key things are our God is, and our God is active, and our God is able. Do you believe those? This makes me a bit uncomfortable, what I'm about to do, because I really don't like calling names. It sounds a little bit... The world in the next set of years is going to applaud spirituality. You're not going to have to worry whether the world's upset because you're spiritual. The problem is the world is going to hate the kind of spiritual life you choose. A world that says God is and he knows me by name. God's active and God's able. The world doesn't like that. That's far different than theirs. The part that makes me uncomfortable, I've been reading Oprah's website for the last 3 weeks or month on a regular basis. Few people, I think, in many ways want to do good more than Oprah. Few people I know of have more influence in this culture than Oprah. But you need to know that the brand that Oprah is selling, that is packaged and sold and sold and sold and sold. Oprah will tell you on her own website, she used to call herself a Christian. But there was a day that a preacher preached a sermon that God is a jealous God. And she said, I was sitting in the audience, and when he preached a God who was personal and petty, because what else could God be if he's jealous? That's petty. And she said, I had to reject that. And she said, I walked out of there that day deciding that God is, but God is not personal and God's not petty. And so she connects you on her website to her spiritual guru. And her spiritual guru basically says there's a life force that everybody can tap into, good or bad, no matter who you are. You can tap into a life force. And that life force desires to come through you. And if you'll just stare at something beautiful, concentrate on something beautiful, you'll begin to get a glimpse and an image of the life force. And Oprah begins to sell a God who by this definition a God is, and a God who is active, and a God who is able. And you have to decide whether you stand bowed in this culture or unbowed. What are you going to do? When Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life, and nobody comes to the Father. When Jesus said, I'm the good shepherd, and I lay down my life for the sheep. When Jesus said, if you want what the Father's like, look at me. You've got to decide which one you're going to believe. The guru who teaches spirituality, how are you going to stand? I can tell you right now, the idol will always be on the plains in front of you. For the sake of Christ, have you ever stood in fearful places? It's in standing in fearful places that profound changes really take place in your life. It's practicing your faith in fearful places that transformation occurs. I've heard Wayne Bushnell tell the same story. I've heard Rick tell it. Wayne Bushnell grew up in a Christian home, and he grew up in a Christian school, and both of those are good and wonderful things. I'm not taking any shots of any kind at either one of those, but Wayne Bushnell will tell you that the greatest transformation occurred in his life when he was asked to play basketball for Missouri Southern State University. And Wayne said, I went on to a team, and he said, when I got on the team, I had to decide guys that are pretty lost and guys that are pretty pagan and guys whose worlds are pretty chaotic, and I had to decide, what am I? Am I quiet and I simply hope they don't notice, or do I stand unbowed with with grace toward them, but I stand unbowed, uncompromising. And Wayne Bushnell will tell you that all the transformation that occurred in a Christian school and in his own home, it pales in comparison to when he stood unbowed. First of all, an oddity and a strange thing, and later on, greatly respected and greatly admired. But an unbowed man is a rare thing. I'll tell you my own kids. My own son, Troy. Troy sat in a law school. It happened before then as well, but Troy sat in, is he going through law school? What am I? Who am I? Do I basically give and bow a little to the culture? Do I really believe what I really believe? And Troy's transformation is when he was unbowed. Katie and Megan, same stories. Living a transformed life will never take place in the greenhouse. It'll take place in front of the statue. And that transformed life that many of you are still seeking, as long as you keep avoiding danger and fearful places, you'll never have it. Can you stand without compromise? There'll be a couple today living together. And you come and you worship, and something spiritual and godly begins to work in one of your hearts. And you begin to say, I love the other one, but what I'm doing's not right. But I don't want to lose them. I hate to lose them. I want to have a life and a family with them. But what I'm doing is compromising something, and you're standing in a fearful place. What do I do? What do I do? And somebody today will go home and say, sweetheart, I love you very much, and I want a life and a family with you, but not this way. Not in a way that dishonors Christ. And somebody will stand in a fearful place. There'll be a husband and a wife here that you're so exhausted because of just the beatings you've taken left and right and what occurs in your marriage and a breakdown of something within your lives. And you simply say, boy, it would be easier to walk away. But there'll be people in this room who decide that God is, and God is active, and God is able. And I will stand in the fearful place and I will fight for my marriage. And I will stand unbowed as I do what is right in the sight of God for the sake of the kingdom. Guess we ought to get to the rest of the story before you go home. The rest of the story is pretty simple. Nebuchadnezzar is furious when they say, you can throw us in the furnace, but it doesn't really matter. We're not going to bow. Nebuchadnezzar says, heat the furnace up 7 times hotter. I don't know that they had a thermometer. Typically, the Hebrew phrase 7 times typically means complete. Make the furnaces as hot as you can make them. Make them perfectly, I mean, to the top of what they can possibly go. It was so hot that when they opened the doors to the furnaces, the entrance of the oxygen even to it, the starved oxygen to the fire, explodes out and burns the very soldiers getting ready to throw in, the Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And it kills the men outside. And 3 men tumble into the furnaces. Holy smoke, what happens? And you know the rest of the story. The king walks up and the king looks in and he said, didn't we throw 3 in? Tell me why there's 4 standing there. And you have a profound place where the God of all creation, who creates everything that ever occurred, that God who put the laws in nature can decide anytime he wants to suspend them, change them, or make them just suggestions. And the God of all creation with the 4th man in the fire, and they're not injured. Verses 28 and 29, then Nebuchadnezzar said, praise be to the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who sent his angel and rescued his servants. They trusted in him and defied the king's command and were willing to give up their lives rather than serve or worship any god except their own. The very last line in that passage is, for no other god can save this way. If you're living a tasteless, pureed pabulum of a Christian life. It will be humorless and joyless, and it will be untried and untested. If you're living the real thing, you will stand in the middle of fearful places. Verse 17 of chapter 3 is absolutely essential, but so too is verse 18. Verse 18, let's go back, because there's a second thing they had said. They had said, our God is able, but here's what they finished with as well. But even if our God does not save us, we want you to know, O king, we will not serve your gods nor worship the image of gold you've set up. You realize, don't you, that they made this decision entirely unknown the result. That concept of God, I'm willing to serve you no matter whether it turns out that I see a miracle or I don't see a miracle. It's irrelevant. I stand unbowed. God, here's my life. I give it to you. You choose whether you do a miracle and rescue me or not. You choose whether I die in the fire. I don't care, God. Either way, I stand unbowed. You need to know that this God who is able, but should he not, I'll still serve him, is the profound statement of all believers that have been legitimate through the ages. Job says, I don't understand it. I don't know how this takes place. I know God is able. I don't know. But though he slay me, yet will I serve him. Paul writes to Philippians chapter 1, to the Philippian church, I'm with the Praetorian Guard. I don't want to live or die. I don't know whether God will intervene like he did before. I don't have any idea. But it doesn't really matter. I shall serve him in that concept. You're going to find David does the same thing. I don't know, God, what you're going to do, but I will serve you. You're going to find your own voice has to say that. Here's where we end up. I recognize that by my limited human vision, I have a very limited view in my goals. And I know God's goals are different than mine. My goal, oftentimes, pretty simple. I want life to be easier, smoother, better. God's goal is this. He wants my life to be purified. He wants the kingdom advanced. And there is no doubt that God wants to be glorified. On those three things, my life purified and the kingdom advanced and the God be glorified, the reality is sometimes that will happen best by God intervening and do a miracle. There are people in this room who have tremendous stories of how God purified your life, how the kingdom was advanced, and he was glorified because something happened that he intervened in your life. I also know that standing here, I do not know what the future holds, and I have to be able to say, God, you don't owe me one more miracle. You don't owe me one more thing. And God, if you never send your angels, God, if you can purify my life and you can advance the kingdom and you can be glorified, and my death or my being crushed is part of it, you are my God. Here I am. Living by faith in a fearful place. That's what's so profound to me about our dear friend who I think is probably killed. He knew it all along. And I stand in a suit in an air-conditioned room in one of the finest facilities. I get to talk about spiritual things. And here was a little man who loved Christ enough and was a friend of ours from the mid-90s on. One time got to sit at our table. Several times we sat at his table. And through translators repeatedly, he kept saying, I don't know what the future holds, but it doesn't matter. By life or by death, I'll serve him. And he'd already made the decision. And when police officers came and took him away, he stood unbowed. And if he's in a prison cell somewhere, I still know where I stand. Unbowed. I ask you again, tell me, is there any other way to follow Christ that you know of? Tell me of your scars and your faithfulness. As the praise team comes, would you put up Hebrews 11 on the screen? In Hebrews, the 11th chapter, You have a profound text. It's a record of what faith looks like. Almost feel like you almost ought to kneel as this passage is read. It almost feels like a passage that I don't even have the right to stand here, but myself to kneel as I read it and say, Randy, this is the reality of the Christian life. Not the charade that's passed around, not the substitute artificial stuff. This is the real one. Hebrews 11, verse 32. What more shall we say? I don't have time to tell you about Gideon or Barak or Samson or Jephthah or David or Samuel or the prophets, who through faith conquered kingdoms and administered justice and gained what was promised, who shut the mouth of lions and quenched the fury of the flames and escaped the edge of the sword, whose weakness was turned into strength and who became powerful in battle, and they routed foreign armies. And women received back their dead, raised to life again. But you keep reading. And others were tortured and refused to be released so they might gain a better resurrection. And some faced jeers and floggings, while still others were chained and put in prison. They were stoned. They were sawn in two. They were put to death by the sword. They went about in sheepskins and goatskins, destitute and persecuted and mistreated. And the world wasn't worthy of them. They wandered in deserts and mountains and caves and holes in the ground. And they were all commended for their faith. Yet none of them received what had been promised. Well, what's that mean? They were still waiting for the Christ you know. They were still waiting for the cross you got to see. They were living on the faith of what God would do in the future. You live on the basis of what God's already done. God has planned something better for us so that only together with us will they be made perfect. Same cross rescued them. Chapter 12, verse 1. Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses. That's a list of all those who've gone ahead. Unbowed men and women. Let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us. Let us fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him, he endured the cross, scorning its shame, and he sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured such opposition from sinful men, so that you will not grow weary and you won't lose heart. They only make one legitimate biblical faith. And it will leave you standing in fearful places. And your only hope is this. Do I believe that God is? Do I believe that God is active and personal? And do I believe that God is able? I stand. And should he not choose to rescue me, but to bring about my purification and the advancement of the kingdom and his glory, by either way, it's okay. I stand unbound. The invitation hymn is for those of you that are believers. You better state again in your own mind what you believe. Those of you that are not believers, if you've lived a compromised life, a lot of reasons, would you come visit with leadership? We'd love to talk to you. This is the road of faith. Would you stand as we sing?